fundamentalism. We have groups very well armed who swoop on villages, and they cite fidelity to Islam. Now, these are the real enemies, not Muslims.
So,
and so when we have sweeping statements like that of Trump, he's not making things easy for there to be a resolution, because it's expanding the zones, the regions of hostility, expanding them to an extent that it becomes unstoppable.
Well, Ashwayanka, we only have a minute, and I did want to repeat, since it's so important, his quote, if we attack, it will be fast, vicious, and sweet, is what he said. But I wanted to ask you in this last 30 seconds, why your visa was revoked to the United States?
I have a feeling that I haven't been flattering Donald Trump, and I see no reason to do that. And there have been occasions when I've had to speak up quite bluntly.
You compared him to Idi Amin of Uganda?
Yes. I think Trump should be flattered by the fact that I compared him to Idi Amin. I mean, Trump has said he likes war. I mean, I'm quoting him. Idi Amin was a man of war and brutality. Idi Amin considered himself a liberator. He called himself the last king of Scotland. He was going to liberate Scotland from the British.
Well, Ashwayanka, we have to wrap, but I'm going to ask you to stay with us because we're going to do part two of this discussion at democracynow.org. People can check it out. Well, Ashwayanka, Nigerian Nobel Prize winning author. That does it for our show.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Down by the river, where the rain runs cold, there's a frog in Portland, brave and bold. He don't carry signs, he don't throw stones, just hops on the line with a megaphone.
Join me tonight on Prison Pipeline at 6:30 p.m. to hear from protesters at the ICE facility in Portland, Oregon.
Ribbit, 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 let freedom sing. It's a funny old way to do your thing. With a smile and a hop, you can make your stand in a frog suit holding freedom's hand. With the chicken, the shark, and the unicorn parade, we all march proud in the Frog Brigade.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcast, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, SNAP funding will be delayed for the 1 in 6 Oregonians who rely on the federal food program.
National Guard troops are blocked from Portland once again, at least until Friday.
And Clackamas County opens its new stabilization center.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 3rd, 2025. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. American residents that rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, aren't being totally cut off from their benefits, but the support will likely be delayed. Nearly 42 million recipients will get partial funding thanks to federal judges in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. The U.S. Department of Agriculture had planned to freeze payments to SNAP starting November 1st because it said it could no longer keep funding the program due to the federal shutdown. SNAP is funded entirely by the federal government and has never been cut off before. One in six Oregonians rely on the program. It's not clear just how much the Trump administration will approve on the SNAP cards, but partial funding could take up to 2 weeks to arrive. The average monthly benefit is around $177 per month per person. In response to the delay, many U.S. states have boosted aid to local food banks, and some have set up systems to reload benefit cards with taxpayer dollars. Federal judges ruled separately, but similarly Friday, directing the federal government was required to use one fund with roughly $5 billion to pay the program in part. The benefits cost over $8 billion every month. Advocates say halting the food aid forces people to choose between buying groceries and paying other bills. SNAP also supports grocery stores. The USDA sent out a warning to participating grocery stores that they are not allowed to offer discounts to SNAP recipients. The notice says that the program has an equal treatment requirement, and if they do try to offer services for discounts, it would be a violation.
The Trump administration can't deploy National Guard troops to Portland until at least Friday, thanks to a preliminary injunction. On Sunday, a federal judge issued the injunction to allow her to make her decision in the three-day trial that ended Friday. Materials presented focus on whether the protest outside Portland's ICE facility required federalization and deployment of the National Guard. District Court Judge Karen Emmergott wrote in her order that she needs more time to consider the case. She did signal that she did not find a legal basis to federalize and deploy National Guard troops to Portland to protect ICE from protesters. The Trump administration referenced U.S. code that allows the president to take control of a state's National Guard if there's a rebellion, invasion, or if he can't execute the laws of the U.S. Emmergott said the protests outside the ICE facility, quote, are likely not a rebellion and likely do not pose a danger of rebellion. She added the attacks that did occur predominantly involved violence between protesters and counter-protesters, not violence against federal officers or the ICE facility. Emmergott said between the dates of June 15th and September 27th, federal and local law enforcement were able to manage the situation outside of ICE. As part of the preliminary injunction, Oregon National Guard troops can stay federalized but cannot deploy before the court's upcoming decision on the 7th. That leaves 200 Oregon National Guard members from units based in Salem and Woodburn waiting at Camp Rylea, where they have been waiting since early October. Judges from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals are still set to rehear the Trump administration's appeal of an order preventing deployment of the Oregon National Guard to Portland. Emmergott's final ruling will almost certainly be appealed as well.
Two groups of advanced practice providers, including nurse practitioners and nurse midwives, have voted to authorize a strike at OHSU and Legacy Health. The providers say they do that they do too many hours of unpaid work and do not feel valued. Isabel Charlet has the details.
Advanced practice providers represented by the Oregon Nurses Association at Oregon Health and Science University and Legacy Health have voted overwhelmingly to authorize strikes if they are unable to agree to contracts soon. APPs, which include physician associates, nurse practitioners, and certified nurse midwives, say they are pushing for sustainable workloads, competitive wages, and more recognition. According to Lee Worsing, a trauma physician associate at Legacy Emanuel Medical Center, APPs are expected to complete hours of unpaid administrative tasks like emailing with patients or ordering medication.
If 5 o'clock rolls around and people are getting injured and getting hurt and it gets super busy in the ER, those day shift providers are going to stay well past the time that their shift ends, we stay and we're not paid.
Legacy has announced they are closing 6 clinics in the Portland area due to financial pressure, projecting to lose $38 million this year. Worsing counters that Legacy is doing better than they say publicly, citing a recent 7.5% raise to all nurses, which she says will cost them at least $50 million. Chelsea Chapman, a physician associate at OHSU in Klamath Falls, is one of 700 APPs who voted to authorize a strike. After almost 2 years spent bargaining for their first union contract, she says she hopes the vote will motivate OHSU to come to the table.
APPs are united, we're organized, and we're really ready to stand up for a fair contract with fair pay, safe workloads, and really the respect we deserve as essential members of the healthcare team.
Before any strike can occur, a 10-day notice would need to be sent to Legacy and OHSU management. With no strike date set, APPs from both systems emphasize that striking is a last resort and they are committed to reaching a fair agreement at the bargaining table. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Tuesday is Election Day. Ballots are due in drop boxes by 8 p.m. Ballots can be postmarked by 8 on Tuesday, but election officials recommend dropping off ballots to ensure they get there on time. It is an off-year special election, meaning there are fewer things for voters to consider. Portland voters are weighing an increase to the Portland Parks Levy, something that parks advocates say is critical to the future of the city parks system. Voters in Gladstone are considering whether the city should be annexed into the Clackamas Fire District for emergency services. The fire district has been serving Gladstone since 2022 under a temporary service contract. Before that contract, Gladstone said it was difficult to staff its own small fire department. Voters in the Lake Oswego School District will vote on whether to authorize over $200 million in bonds for upgrading school infrastructure with new fire alarms and earthquake preparedness. Washington County voters will decide on an extension of their library service levy at a rate of 37 cents per $100,000 of assessed value. Voters in Jackson County might decide to increase the lodging tax in Medford to pay for a dedicated conference center. Ballots are due by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, November 4th. Ballot drop box locations can be found online through each county's election website.
Clackamas County opened its new stabilization center today, meant for locals who are in mental health crisis. The site will offer short-term behavioral health support and recovery, along with a dozen transitional housing beds. The county says it's intended to help people experiencing panic attacks, hallucinations, or with anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, eating disorders, and other addictive behaviors. It's located on Southeast McBroad Avenue in Milwaukee. The center will be open 24/7, but they don't take walk-ups. People will have to be referred by police and mobile crisis responders. The county says it's an important addition to a growing network of recovery-oriented systems of care. Governor Tina Kotek was at the grand opening today. Kotek says, quote, "For too long, Oregon has struggled with a fragmented mental health and addiction care system where too many people fall through the cracks. We know that a jail bed or an emergency room isn't the ideal destination for individuals experiencing mental health crisis." She continued, quote, "This is a big day for Clackamas County, and it's a big day for our state because of what it says about who we are as Oregonians and what we are doing to make sure when people are in crisis, they can get the help they need when they need it," end quote.
Nebraska farmers struggle as shutdown stalls loans and delays updated farm bill. Indiana Republicans clash over redistricting, and policy experts warn millions could lose Affordable Care Act coverage without tax credits. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Those producers that are the most vulnerable are those that have been in agriculture the shortest amount of time, which is about a fourth of all the ag producers that have been in for less than 10 years. So they don't have as much equity and they have more operating debt to service.
Nebraska Farmers Union President John Hansen says the federal shutdown, now in its sixth week, is threatening family farms. With USDA offices closed, many can't access the loans they rely on for planting. And that's bad for rural economies, already hit by tariffs and stagnant commodity prices. Many farmers get their health insurance through Obamacare, and the ACA exchanges are now allowing open enrollment. But with insurance subsidies still set to expire, Gideon Lukens at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says millions could be priced out of coverage. He says, for example, nearly a million people in North Carolina could see their premiums double.
Even if tax credits are eventually extended, every day that goes by without an extension means more people dropping coverage and ending up uninsured next year.
Lynn Cowles, with Every Texan, is watching the impact of that and cuts to Medicaid on already struggling small rural hospitals.
Hospitals will have to transfer the cost of caring for uninsured people onto the insurance companies of people who do have health insurance. Right now, there are 21 rural hospitals across Texas that are at risk of closure.
President Donald Trump is facing backlash for hosting a lavish Great Gatsby-themed gala at Mar-a-Lago in spite of the shutdown. Historians note that during the Roaring Twenties, farmers in rural areas were already suffering a deep economic shutdown that many call a cause of the Great Depression. The president's redistricting hopes are not moving forward in Indiana at the moment. Former Republican strategist Megan Robertson, now with Indiana Conservation Voters, says there is a divide between the White House and the state's GOP lawmakers, worried about challenges in court. That's in spite of the efforts of the Republican Governor Mike Braun.
The legislature has told him specifically they don't have the votes, but he keeps pushing forward because he's listening to Washington insiders instead of Hoosiers.
Hundreds packed a Newark, New Jersey college gym to hear former President Barack Obama speak in support of the Democratic candidate for governor. Supporters wrapped around multiple blocks for the Get Out the Vote rally for Representative Mikey Sherrill. Nine people are recovering after a gunfire erupted at a birthday party at an Airbnb rental near Akron, Ohio. Police say most attendees were teenagers. There have been more than 360 mass shootings so far this year. Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom calls a new deployment of so-called National Guard strike teams to U.S. cities an assault on democratic institutions. He's joining other governors in suing. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of about 48 degrees. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a high of 59. Today in history, in 1986, the Compact of Free Association becomes law, granting the Federated States of Micronesia and the Marshall Islands independence from the United States. The quote of the day is from Indian-American economist and philosopher Amartya Sen. Born this day in 1933, he said, quote, "Democracy has to be judged not just by the institutions that formally exist, but by the extent to which different voices from diverse sections of the people can actually be heard."
A Catholic order in Wisconsin is transferring land to a tribal nation in the name of reparations, the first known instance of this type of land transfer. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In a historic moment, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration have transferred land to the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. As Danielle Kading reports, it's the first known land transfer nationwide from a Catholic institution to a tribal nation in the name of reparations.
The transfer aims to repair the painful legacy of federal Indian boarding schools. From the early 19th century until 1969, Native American children were removed from their homes and forced to assimilate. The Franciscan Sisters transferred its Mary Wood Franciscan Spirituality Center in Arbor Vitae to Lac des Flambeaux. Araya Breedlove, the tribe's spokesperson, says it's a significant moment.
Having this be the first time, as we know of at least, that any institution has given land back in regards to reparations, it's rare that we see the acknowledgement of that hurt and the generational trauma.
Sue Ernster is president of the Franciscan Sisters.
We do see this as the beginning of deepening the relationship and really helping to heal our part of the trauma.
The band purchased the property for $30,000. While the Spirituality Center was never a boarding school, the Franciscan Sisters ran St. Mary's Catholic Indian Boarding School on the Bad River Tribes Reservation in Wisconsin. Officials with the Lac des Flambeaux tribe say they're grateful for the sisters' kindness and willingness to acknowledge the hurt and trauma from boarding schools. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A Kodiak-based nonprofit dedicated to supporting families with newborns is expanding into the Northwest Arctic Borough. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports on how Kodiak Kindness is helping families across Alaska raise babies.
For years, Noyuk Wanda Baltazar has been teaching infants in Kotzebue through a local program that serves children with disabilities or delayed development. It's the only such program based out of a school district in the state. Baltazar says it's about helping kids from birth to 3 years old and their families around the Manilik service area, which covers 12 communities in northwest Alaska from Kotzebue to Kobuk.
Working with birth to three, it's always good about helping families, ensuring that they're strong, supported, and any way we can support families and nursing moms to help their babies grow, I think is great.
Baltazar and Francis Williams from Ambler are bringing their experience working with children to Kodiak Kindness as they continue doing what they already do, but under the new title of peer counselors. Williams, who is known in her hometown as the village mother, says being part of the organization will give her more support and tools to do things she already does on a regular basis in the Northwest Arctic community.
Kodiak Kindness would be able to help because there's a lot of things that I learned when we went to the trainings. Things that we didn't know. So all the training will be able to help. Like, I'll be able to do my own mix, you know, with Kodiak Kindness and my Inupiaq traditions.
Williams says she uses native plants like stinkweed or spruce trees to make salves or other traditional medicines to help her friends, family, and neighbors heal from the land. Aside from the traditional knowledge Williams has from her mom and aunties, she'll also be able to help her community with assistance from a certified lactation consultant if she wants support virtually from the Kodiak Kindness team via telehealth. Kodiak Kindness's two new peer counselors in the Northwest Arctic Borough come online this winter and hope to start enrolling families in the region early next year. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Census data shows Washington State has seen an overall decline in the poverty rate, but experts are concerned about the growing wage gap, especially how that impacts residents of color. Data shows that the gap between the richest and the poorest continues to widen nationally. Isabel Charlet has more.
The latest U.S. Census data shows Washington's poverty rate declined slightly overall, but the wage gap continues to grow, leaving experts concerned about rising inequality in the state. Research finds that pay gains have slowed rapidly for the lowest income earners across the country, with the top quarter of earners now making more than five times as much as the lowest earners. While the poverty rate in Washington decreased slightly between 2023 and 2024, Annie Kuklick with the Economic Opportunity Institute says it does not overshadow the larger trend of income inequality in the state.
We see that the lowest 20% of income earners in Washington take home only 3% of aggregate income, while the top 5% are taking home 22%. And that has grown pretty significantly over the last 20 years or so.
Kuklick explains that census data based on the federal poverty definition does not always accurately reflect how Washington families are doing. She says the self-sufficiency standard developed by the University of Washington is more accurate because it takes into account what families need to meet their basic needs in their area, including food, healthcare, childcare, and transportation. Using the self-sufficiency standard, Kuklick says, paints a grim picture for the state. That data shows nearly 30% of Washington households overall are not able to meet their basic needs, with people of color facing disproportionate impacts.
We found that 45% of Black households in Washington state are not able to meet basic needs. 45% of Hispanic households and 44% of Indigenous households.
It is essential to have an accurate understanding of the challenges facing the state, says Kuklick, so people know how to start addressing them. She says looking to the market to ensure people are paid fairly has not worked and advocates for progressive taxation to redistribute wealth. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A new analysis from the Annie E. Casey Foundation finds that child poverty across the country almost tripled from 2021 to 2024, hitting 11% in Oregon and 18% in California. Suzanne Potter reports.
Child poverty in California hit 18% last year, 5 points higher than the national average, according to a new analysis by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Researchers found that the national child poverty rate almost tripled from 5 to 13% between 2021 and 2024, largely because Congress allowed the pandemic-era boost in financial support to low-income families to expire. Leslie Bossier with the Annie E. Casey Foundation says high concentration of poverty endangers children's safety, health, and success in school.
Those neighborhoods often have higher crime rates. Schools tend to have lower resources, and consequently, the academic achievement of the children tends to be lower. You also see significant stress on families, and that stress has a direct impact on the well-being of children.
The numbers are much worse for children of color. Child poverty nationally stands at 7% for white children, 21% for Latino kids, and 23% for Black children. Last July, the Republican budget bill did increase the maximum child tax credit by $200 a year, but it also made huge cuts to programs that help low-income families, like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program and Medicaid. Bossier says wages and poverty-alleviating policies simply aren't keeping up with costs, so policymakers need to look for solutions.
It's a partnership that involves both the business community and the support of wages to allow families to support their children, and also policies that provide supports for families who are living in lower wage situations.
The report also found that without current social support programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Child Tax Credit, SNAP, and housing assistance, child poverty in California would jump to 29%, pushing 880,000 more Golden State children into poverty. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A new report spotlights the economic impacts of lost immigrant workers under the Trump administration's mass deportation policies. Medicare and Social Security, which are largely funded through payroll taxes, are expected to be negatively impacted. Eric Galatis has the details.
As President Donald Trump makes good on campaign promises to deport immigrants living in Colorado and across the U.S. without proper documentation, a new report spotlights the economic risks to Social Security and other programs that rely on payroll tax revenues. As America's baby boomers continue to retire, the number of U.S.-born workers is expected to dramatically decrease over the next decade. Report author Josh Bivens says historically normal GDP growth rates will be impossible to maintain without immigrant workers.
It does make things like Social Security and Medicare a little harder to sustain. If we have a steady flow of younger immigrant workers coming in, that just makes it much easier to sustain those really important social insurance programs.
Medicare and Social Security are largely funded by today's workers, regardless of their immigration status, through payroll taxes. According to Social Security trustees, the program will not be able to pay full benefits after 2036. The Trump administration says it hopes to deport deport 1 million immigrants each year to secure borders and jobs for U.S.-born workers. More than 1.2 million immigrants disappeared from the U.S. labor force in the first half of 2025, according to Pew Research Center analysis. Increases in immigration actually lead to more jobs overall and higher wages for U.S.-born workers, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. Bivens warns that the loss of immigrant workers will also hurt U.S.-born workers.
The really immigrant-heavy part of residential construction is maybe the framing and digging out the foundation. Well, if that doesn't get done, the part of construction that is more intensive in the use of U.S.-born workers, like maybe the electrician and the plumber, they can't do their work.
Immigrants make up nearly 20% of the overall U.S. workforce. Nearly half of farming, fishing, and home health care work is done by immigrants, 30% of all construction workers, and 24% of service industry workers are immigrants. This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Experts say that as natural disasters become more common because of climate change, it's important to safeguard your documents. They say that preparing copies of insurance documents, passports, and in advance can help people access care, file claims, and rebuild faster if the worst happens. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Disasters like wildfires, hurricanes, and floods can take everything, from photo albums and family heirlooms to entire homes. Rebuilding after a tragedy is always hard, but it can be even harder if you lose critical financial and personal documents. The best way to keep this information safe is to prepare before a disaster hits. First, gather all your important documents together. Those include Social Security cards, birth certificates, and passports, along with records such as property deeds and vehicle titles. You'll also need financial and legal documents such as wills, tax returns, and bank statements. And don't forget your health and home insurance policies, which you may need in order to get medical care during an emergency and to rebuild afterwards. Then make copies of everything. Keep one copy in a secure place, like a safety deposit box, and put another copy in a go bag with emergency supplies that you can grab if a disaster hits. You can also store copies digitally in a password-protected hard drive or in the cloud. As the climate warms, disasters like floods, wildfires, and hurricanes will become more common and severe across the country. So everyone should make a plan to keep important documents safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 3rd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dave Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Eric Galatis, Farah Siddiqui, Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.1.